This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. Today we're talking about the 30th anniversary of the Heartland International Film Festival, which started last week and lasts until this Sunday. We'll talk to a few of the filmmakers who have projects at the event, and later we'll hear from someone from Heartland to talk about how they put it all together this year. And we're joined now by Bob Massey, executive producer of the documentary Letters Home. Welcome, Bob. So can you tell us, what is this documentary about?
Hi, Jill. Thank you very much for having me today. Letters Home is the story of a couple of history sleuths. My son is a Marine Corps veteran, and we have, for a long time, found World War II memorabilia that's been separated from the families. We've researched the story behind the soldier, put it together, and then tracked the families down to reinstate these things to the families. So often they get lost in estate sales and things like that. Mm-hmm. Well, it just so happened in one instance, we tracked the family down and found that the World War II soldier was still alive and had an absolute heartrending, wonderful reunion of this soldier with the memorabilia that he had lost 40 years ago. Wow. So this is the story of that process of my son and I doing our thing and ultimately finding Joe Barris in Utica, New York.
Wow. So obviously you have a real passion for the topic of this documentary. And when you heard this story, was that the real impetus for the idea for your film?
Well, actually, I had just retired from my longtime business, turned it over to my son-in-law, and had always wanted to do documentary filmmaking. Well, I was casting about for a project when this was going on. And my wife said, honey, you want to make a movie? Why don't you just tell the story of what you and Matt are doing? Because it certainly has emotional power with connecting with this 90-year-old combat veteran who was just moved to his depths that we found this and returned it. So that became the first project in my third or fourth career.
And we're going to get into your previous career as well, because it's interesting, your background. But when you're deciding, you know, when you come across a story like this, why make a documentary? Has it always been a passion of yours, like you said, to make documentaries? I mean, you could tell the story in a lot of ways. Is that right?
That's a really great question. This seemed to me like it could be best told as a documentary about this journey that my son and I have and the happy conclusions. This happened to be the most moving one, but we've had some really amazing family connections. We just never had this connection with the soldier himself. Joe is still alive, and it all worked out for us. We could have taken a different path, but because it was my first film, I felt like it would be better to tell it. I have a lot of passion about history and history telling. So I felt like it'd be better to tackle something like that than a scripted drama, and wade into some place that I didn't have a lot of experience in writing or in other artistic expression.
Mm-hmm. So what's it like working with your son on a project like this?
It's great. For anybody who gets a chance to see this, my son makes the comment that my dad and I work really well together. He's never met a stranger, and I like to stand in the corner and just watch everybody. So we're really yin and yang. He's a great, big, good-looking Marine Corps veteran, and I'm short, fat, and ugly. And so we just go together perfectly, you know?
And he has a real passion for telling these stories as well.
Oh, yeah. His grandfather was a World War II veteran. I'm actually on a set right now for a filming tomorrow, so if you hear a bunch of noise in the background, that's what's going on. So in addition to his appreciation of that with his own grandfather, the Marine Corps drills into these guys the respect of the folks on whose shoulders they stand. And so Matt has always been very passionate, and he's actually an expert in military symbology. and the meaning of the awards and the medals and the devices and all that are given to soldiers, airmen, Marines, and sailors for the service that they render. So, yeah, he's very committed.
So you said this is your first film. When did you start making this movie?
I started this in 2016. We actually showed it to a meeting of the American Legion Auxiliary in 2017. It was their national convention. They had been very encouraging of the project for reasons you can imagine. And I actually got on the plane and left Reno and that convention and went straight to Utica for Joe's birthday. It was Labor Day weekend. We had a wonderful surprise birthday party for him. And in addition to the surprise of seeing the film that had been made about him and his service, we also had a big family gathering where a brother and a sister that had been estranged for 25 years came, a wonderful family reunion, and 2 weeks later, Joe passed away. Mm. So the timing was wonderful. The family has been so deeply appreciative of this little surprise. You know, this was just came out of nowhere for them, came out of nowhere for us, but it just worked out wonderfully.
So talk a little bit about your background then. You know, you didn't have a filmmaking background. You came from a business in your previous life, yes?
Well, I started life as a professional musician, and I've always been a writer and an artist. I was in the ministry for 12 years, and a set of circumstances took me into business in 1987. So my business was successful, and 2015, I turned it over to my son-in-law, with whom I'd worked for 25 years, said, you're going to pay my salary for a while. I'm going to go do something I've always wanted to do. And that's how I got into filmmaking business.
So, you know, as someone with a business background, a lot of people starting out in the film industry might not have that background. Are these worlds often separated? And do you think that artists really have or need a better understanding of business?
It would be greatly beneficial to them. Years ago, I did a recording in Nashville. I was in on a session, and there was a guitar player named Billy Grammer that was one of the fixtures around Nashville in that era of recording. And we were on a break, and Billy and I were sitting chatting, and I had come into Nashville. I didn't live there. Billy lived there. He was always on these recording gigs. And we were talking about the talent and the amazing number of great musicians that come through Nashville, Tennessee. And Billy looked at me and he said, Bob, it's a really good secret. But for every one of me, there's 25 better musicians standing out on the street, but they just want to keep their heads in songs and music and not in how to make a living. Yeah. So that was a good lesson back in the days when I was a starving artist too. So yes, I think business training, business support, helping artists find the practical way to express their vision that's a wonderful subject, which you might guess I'm passionate about.
And have you been able to talk to some young artists about business and how they might better delve into that side of it?
Absolutely. Every chance I get with any young person in any area, but especially in this area. And it's funny, when Rocky, one of your other guests, and I were sitting waiting for the call to start, this is exactly what we were talking about. He's a successful filmmaker for 15 years in Noblesville. And we were both talking about how important it is for the business aspect of film to work to support the creative side. And we were actually chatting about the possibility of how do we get the filmmaking community together and see if we can't help bring in resources and boost that in Indiana. You know, one of the issues that we face in Indiana is not the lack of talent. Mm-hmm. It's the lack of incentives. For example, Atlanta and Chicago both have really amazing tax incentives that the big filmmakers take huge advantage of. And we've had folks here in the state that have lobbied the General Assembly for several years and just can't get it through these people's heads that we're not giving money away, we're doing tax credits, which means they get to take a portion of the taxes they would pay to help offset their costs. But those are taxes they would pay only if they come to Indiana. So they're going to Atlanta and Chicago and other places. Hollywood has been really hit hard by the problem because places like Seattle and Atlanta and Chicago have come up with great programs that help the business side of this. And so we would love for that to happen in Indiana, and there is still pressure on for that to happen. It's not moving very quickly, though.
No, I've definitely heard that issue in the State House for a number of years. So maybe we'll see this year. So talk a little bit about, you know, what was the most challenging part of making this film for you?
Wow. Not wanting to do every job on the set. I mean, the challenge, there was so little challenge. It was like put an instrument in a musician's hand with a great piece of music and say, what's the greatest challenge? Oh my gosh. It's like stopping playing. It's such a magnificent, fulfilling experience.
And quickly, we have about 45 seconds left. So you're on the set now. What are you working on?
We have brought the members of the 9/11 Commission to Indiana University. They all gathered yesterday. We're doing small group filmings today. Tomorrow they will be on stage at Indiana University Auditorium filming for 5 hours for a documentary called Are We Safer Today? That will air nationally on public television next fall. AreWeSaferToday.com.
Well, congratulations, Bob, and thank you.
Thank you, Jill. I really appreciate the privilege.
Absolutely. Bob Massey is executive producer of the documentary Letters Home, featured at the Heartland International Film Festival that kicked off last week. We'll be back with more filmmakers after a quick break. If you have questions or comments for us on the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail, 866-476-3881. It's 866-476-3881. I'm Jill Sheridan. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan, filling in today for Miriam Sobe. And we're talking about the 30th anniversary of the Heartland International Film Festival, which started last week and continues until this weekend. Talking to a few filmmakers today who have projects at the event. And up next, we have Rocky Walls, co-founder of 12 Stars Media and co-director of the documentary IMB Prez. Welcome, Rocky. Can you tell us a little bit about what your documentary is about?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. So artist, designer, furniture maker, Indianapolis resident, Brian Presnell. He is just a prolific connector. He seems to know, I mean, in a conversation with Brian, he will mention 100 people and tell you 10 stories at least. And it's just was the kind of person that we met and said, somebody really needs to start filming you because you are just full of interesting stories. And that's what this is about. We followed him for about 18 months and explored how his life experiences from even childhood have impacted his career, the community. And he has this passion for recycling that comes about in the film and is, of course, the foundation for his business in the urban hardwood here in Indianapolis.
Well, we need more of recycling, that's for sure. So good to hear he's got something interesting going on. How did you first hear about Brian? I've not heard of him, you know, being from the area. How did you first hear about him?
Well, I was a customer of his, actually. I'm sitting in my office right now in Noblesville and looking at these beautiful Indiana hardwood floors that we have. When we renovated our office space, I really wanted to do locally harvested Indiana hardwood, sustainably harvested Indiana hardwood. And Brian was the only person that I could find that knew anything about that or even potentially would entertain the idea. And so I actually just went to his shop and met him and talked through that with him and definitely ended up outfitting our floors with his product, which is you know, hardwood trees in India. Most of this is ash. You know, we've lost a tremendous amount of our ash trees in Indiana, and will continue to, unfortunately. And then there's, you know, some oak and walnut that we have here in Indiana, especially in Indianapolis where Brian works. You know, trees come down for a lot of reasons, for development sometimes, but also just because trees need to come down for safety issues and things like that. The ash trees, of course, are coming down because of the emerald ash borer. Mm-hmm. But those trees could be mulched or burned or just end up in a landfill, which is a shame because it's beautiful, really, really valuable wood. And Brian just has this heart and had this heart when he started his company to take that wood and put it to good use.
So he must have made a impression on you when you first met him. What was that?
I mean, I'll say it again. My co-director Grant and I just really looked at each other after we met him for the first time together and said, this guy, we got to make a documentary about this guy. Because his fervor, for just life and connecting with people and telling stories and also amplifying and encouraging others, is just so high and so contagious that, you kind of can't help but walk away feeling a little bit energized and inspired, when you have a conversation with him. And I think that our company, 12 Stars Media, is focused largely on, I mean, we that's what we say. We say we tell the stories of interesting characters who inspire communities to make positive change. Mm. So Brian was just like a perfect fit for that anyway, on top of just having had the personal experience interacting with him and feeling like we just wanted to spend a little more time around him.
So Brian's a super interesting guy. You know, when you do meet someone that is doing some pretty incredible things, you know, how do you decide whether it's worth actually making a film, a documentary about that person?
That's an interesting part of this particular process for us. It was very unique from other documentary work that we've done in which, you know, previously we sort of mm-hmm. have known exactly what the story might be. And we have a pretty clear idea of what, you know, the beginning, middle and end might be. And in this case, we just knew we had the interesting character and we didn't know where it would go. And so for us, we knew we wanted to make a documentary film, but, you know, we never would have been able to pinpoint how long this is going to be or what the actual storyline might be. Will it focus more on the recycling aspects of his business, or will it focus more on him as a person, or will we actually bring in lots of other people and tell their stories too? All of those were question marks when we started. And I think that's a really key element of a lot of really great stories. Oftentimes you have to start and be willing to sort of let the story unfold before you. Otherwise you may not have the chance to go back to where you should have started and start with, you know, only 20/20 hindsight.
Let the story lead. If you're listening live right now, we would love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us at Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first and last name, where you're calling from, 866-476-3881. So, Rocky, is it tricky when you're making a documentary about an individual, about a person, since, you know, I don't know, Brian might want a little input on how things are going?
I imagine it is tricky. I have to say, I imagine it is, because in our case, we were incredibly fortunate to have Brian's full trust. Brian is an artist as well. And so I think very early on in the process, he told me pretty candidly, I'm not going to get in your way. As an artist, you know, I want you to be able to do your work. I want you to be able to, this is your art piece. It happens to be, you know, my life, but you're the artist kind of creating this documentary, this story. And so, you know, he had a great amount of control in what he said, what he shared with us, the parts of his life that he chose to share with us. I mean, we told him, pretty much right from the beginning, Brian, just anytime you think that there's something going on that we might be interested in, or it might be a good fit for the documentary. Just text me and we'll show up and we'll film it. And he took full advantage of that. And we filmed all kinds of crazy stuff. And then also, you know, we got hit with a pandemic, which we didn't know was going to happen when we started this project. And so that factored into the story, not a lot, but a little. Certainly, it was impossible to make a documentary about, you know, the 18 months of someone's life that happened to also contain 2020. Mm-hmm. And so there were aspects of the pandemic and also family tragedy that occurred during the filming that we never would have been able to predict or imagine. And so you just kind of have to, like you said, let the story lead. Mm-hmm.
So when you're texting him and, you know, you're trying to just get that sort of fly on the wall style of documentary where you're really trying to catch Brian and others behaving in a completely natural way. How do you manage the sort of weirdness of just filming and having a camera crew around, though?
Well, so two things. One, that's a big part of what we do every day with 12 Stars Media. I mean, we only do documentary style work. And I think it's really important to convey a level of genuine interest and focus on individuals' comfort and the casual environment. I think that using a small crew, I think that having someone there dedicated to talking to people and helping them to feel comfortable, making sure their questions are answered, all of those kinds of things, all of that is extremely important to helping people feel natural and comfortable and making sure that you don't a performance. I said I had to say two things about that. The second thing is that Brian, as you might have guessed, based on how I've talked about him so far, is very consciously aware of how he comes across. I wouldn't call him a performer as such, but he was also very capable of being candid and natural, but also being extremely cognizant of what he was saying and doing while on camera. So I mean, I hate to say it, but I really think that he was like the perfect documentary subject.
So is there a right way to go about making a documentary, or do things just change, you know, depending on the situation, the project, the individual?
Well, documentary, just the word or the genre, means so many different things. And so I think that there are documentaries that that you can go into and not have to worry about a whole lot of change along the way. But I think that if you're going to follow a character, a person, and really want to tell their story with reverence and respect, I do think you have to be willing to be changed and to be flexible with what you're doing. I think that that's kind of the beauty of it. You asked, you know, if there's a right way and a wrong way. I think there are definitely some wrong ways to do a documentary, just like there's wrong ways to do probably just about everything. But I think that there are a lot of right ways. And so there's not one right way to make a documentary film. I don't even think there's one right way to make this specific kind of documentary film, per se.
And with, you know, this type of documentary, when you're filming like this, and like you said, you know, some of the stories you've told, you know, have a clear beginning, middle, end, but this narrative might not have been so clear. So how do you know when it's done?
Well, for us, and I don't want to give away the ending, sure. But for us, we had been on a long journey with Brian. And I think there was just kind of a moment where he was able to sit down on a bench that he and his team made over at Newfields and reflect back on what he had learned, sort of coming out of the hardest parts of the pandemic, coming out of some really difficult business challenges. And he was able to identify what he considered success to really be. And he was able to articulate that to us. And we kind of, I think, all knew at that point that like a person's life in general, and Brian's life is still going. I mean, Brian's still doing crazy things that we could be out filming right now. But you know, we're not going to follow him for the rest of his life. I think at this point we kind of can look back at what we've gotten and said, this is a good enough slice of his life that somebody could watch it. I mean, the runtime is right at an hour. So it's a really nice, like, digestible amount of content too, where you're able to get a slice of his life and get to know him well enough that you feel really moved by his motivations and his challenges and his success. But at the same time, you know, at the end of the movie, you know, the story goes on. It's going to continue, just like all of our stories do. They continue in one way or another. And, you know, we to just kind of look back at the slices.
You know, being from Noblesville, 30 years for the Heartland, how important is it, the film festivals, for filmmakers, especially, you know, Indiana filmmakers working on these kinds of projects?
Immensely, immensely. I mean, I think without our festivals and some of the other organizations that help elevate the film industry here in Indiana, we would be at such a disadvantage. You know, Bob mentioned the tax incentives, you know, and that's a battle that we need to continue to fight. But I'm very grateful that we have a lot of people working really hard. Heartland has so many volunteers on top of their staff working hard to make this whole festival a success. And for filmmakers like me, like the others that you've got on this call, and then, like, you know, dozens and dozens, hundreds throughout 30 years, if not thousands, of filmmakers, the experience of going to a festival and having people watching and clapping and asking questions and truly invested in the story that you felt so compelled to share is absolutely priceless. And, you know, I can't thank Heartland and their staff and their volunteers enough for the opportunity. It's just, it really does mean a lot. And then I think also then the community that Heartland builds, you know, to say to everybody, hey, remember that these folks like our team, like Brian, the subject of our film, and then all the other films and filmmakers and subjects represented at Heartland, we need this community. We're nothing without the people who are going to come and watch the films that we make. So, it's just very, very meaningful and couldn't be more honored to be a part of it.
Yeah, what's that like, watching something that you've worked on for so long with an audience, especially after the last year and a half in a theater?
I mean, after the last year and a half, it's incredibly rewarding. I mean, I think that it's almost surreal. There was an element of, like, is this, you know, like, how should I even feel right now? Because it's very different. But yeah, it's wonderful. I know that a lot of filmmakers do this. A lot of listeners might not know the filmmakers do this, but, you know, when we're watching our film, most of the time when we're in a theater, full of guests enjoying our film, we're not watching the film, we're watching them. I'm looking at their facial expressions. I'm waiting for some tears to fall, or I'm waiting, to find out if the things that we thought would be the funniest really, really hit home in the way that we had hoped. And so, you know, you viewers become our subject, our focus when we're there watching our films most of the time.
Do you think, you know, with that in mind, that filmmakers and crews are starting to bounce back now after the hit we might have taken during the pandemic? I mean, you mentioned you filmed during the pandemic.
I absolutely think so. And of course I hope so. You know, part of the challenge of filmmaking, especially documentary filmmaking, was that not only do we want to be safe, but we have to have things happening in order to film, you know? And so it's like, I mean, there were a lot of people who made documentaries about the experience of being in the pandemic. And that's great. I'm glad that moment in time, or moments, many, many moments in time, have been captured. But I think that there are also a lot of stories that you couldn't document during a pandemic, because the things that would normally be happening just weren't. And so I think now, as things, you know, as it does become safer for people to be together again and doing some of the things that we might have been doing 2 or 3 years ago, I think the opportunities to tell those stories have presented themselves more abundantly, and then therefore the storytellers and the filmmakers will get out there and do the work.
Well, just really quickly, any big lesson, any takeaway, you know, after all of your years doing this?
So not just with IMDprez, but with documentary filmmaking in general, I think it's really important to find the niche that you fit and the type of work that you really want to do the most and to focus in it. You can't not necessarily always pick that right out of the gate. You might do a couple of projects that you feel like, you know, are you're sort of testing the waters and trying a few new things. But for me, narrowing in and understanding that I'm passionate about telling the stories of interesting characters who inspire communities to make positive changes is, you know, was a big revelation. And I hope that everybody interested in film can find their niche.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Rocky Walls, co-founder of 12 Stars Media and co-director of the documentary IMB Prez, which is featured this week at the 30th anniversary of the Heartland International Film Festival. You can comment, find us today at Facebook or Twitter, All in Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan, filling in today for Miriam Soeb. And we're talking about the 30th anniversary of the Heartland International Film Festival, which kicked off last week and lasts until this Sunday at locations around Indianapolis. As always, we'd love to hear your questions and comments. Find us at Facebook and Twitter, All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your name, where you're calling from, 866-476-3881. And we're joined now by another filmmaker with a project at the event. Andrew Paul Davis is creative director and founder of One Country Film Company and director of the film Pompano Boy. Welcome, Andrew.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for being here. And could you tell us a little bit about what your film is about?
Yeah, so the logline for Pompano Boy is a conflicted minister reckons with his marriage and a new foster child. Meanwhile, the foster child's mother tries to get her son back, her past coming back to haunt her. So we're sort of following the journey of this foster child and the two different worlds he exists in.
Yeah, it could be a very difficult world to exist in. So what made you want to make a film about this topic?
Yeah, foster care. I did not grow up in foster care, but my grandfather did. My sister worked in it. The church I grew up in, it was sort of like a focus there as well. And in college, I sort of made child psychology kind of like an extra focus I was interested in. And kind of just felt that there was a lot there to unpack, and that maybe isn't always presented in mainstream media or advertisements or, you know, just sort of like how we often think about foster care in terms of how it's presented to us in media. You know, it's often like a happy couple taking in a child potentially of a different race, and maybe coming from a different class as well. And just kind of wanted to portray that and show that it doesn't happen the same way every time. You know, it can be awkward, it can be messy, maybe it can be funny. But ultimately, it's just very hard for a child to, like, you know, I just kind of wanted to show how intense that might be, you know, to just kind of be pulled back and forth between such different environments like that.
Yeah, agree. There's really not a lot on that topic in the movie world. So this is not a documentary film, correct?
Correct. We got a narrative feature here. Yeah.
So you've worked on a lot of projects, I understand, before this, including a number of short films. Was this a bigger film than you're used to working on?
Yes. Budgetarily speaking, and I guess some of the scale was the biggest project. This is my second feature length thing, and the budget was about like four times the amount. We had a couple more people on set, and that was exciting. You know, in all the shorts I've done, you know, it's sometimes just like a friend holding a boom pole who doesn't know how to use a boom pole, and it's just kind of like learning that day. So it's sort of like gradually grown. And, you know, the first film added a couple more people. And then on this film, you know, just had a couple more key players, like someone just being a gaffer, you know, like someone just focused on the lighting and someone just doing art directing. So, yeah, it was a 19-day shoot. And we filmed it at the very end of 2019, very beginning of 2020. And now it's ready to show. And this will be the second time an audience sees it at Heartland.
That's great. So, you know, when you do have more resources, we always think about, you know, the filmmaker that starts out, like you said, with his buddy, and you have more resources now for a project like this. I assume that, you know, with a lower budget, it might not be with more money in your pocket, is it difficult, or the business side more obvious how to use the money in the right way?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say too that like this is still like a pretty low budget film, but it's kind of like the more money you get for a film, it's like it's very easy to make it go to zero. It's like, oh no, like let's, you know, spend $1,000 on a publicist, or like, you know, it's like let's finally get legal help, or like, you know, there's too many ways to use up a dollar on a film set that it you know, you don't like get greedy per se, but your sort of like sense of how much you have just always feels like a little less than what would be comfortable.
Well, I was, you know, talking with Bob in the first segment about just, you know, the business side of it. Are you, I mean, is that an important piece of the puzzle, you know, really learning that in a more impactful way?
Yeah, I mean, our focus has been like kind of like marketing directly to people we know and people the film might be relevant to. The piece that's been missing for us is sort of like working with sales agents and distributors. So I'm still in like a very, very independent, you know, stage of my career, which is pretty early. But yeah, I mean, it's the things that are important to me about the business are like, you pay people the day they show up and do their thing. You know, it's just like you be professional and on top of it, and make sure everyone has a good experience. You know, that should kind of be the goal. But in terms of how to like, you know, sell these things, it's like, you can't, that's not a guarantee, you know, it's a risk. But I think because film is so associated with entertainment, filmmakers have like a higher aptitude for believing that like they might make a lot of money on a film. But we have to remember that like, more and more of us are doing it now, and we're in the arts. So like, you aren't always gonna like profit off of these things. So that's where, you know, passion and a love for the stories we're telling sort of like carries it through. You know, not sustainable for the rest of my life, but at least for right now, I can sort of like invest and go for it.
Well, who knows? I mean, and with the festivals, I mean, how important are festivals like, you know, the Heartland for filmmakers, do you think, even in recent years?
Yeah, it's wind in the sails. And what happened with my first feature was we started getting a couple more acceptances and like private invitations to festivals as a result of getting into Heartland. So we have festivals in the country that respect Heartland and the films they program and know that it's like, oh, okay, like this is going to be, these are going to be good stories and good films, hopefully. It can sort of compound, you know, you don't want to, at least I'm of the opinion, you don't want to like put every single obscure festival on your poster and you're like 100 laurels, but there are like dozens of great festivals in this country and in other countries as well that carry meaning, you know. And it's like, if I've been planning a self-distributed tour of the film in December, and we're looking to hit three different places in Indiana, do a screening in Bloomington, another one in Indianapolis, and maybe one in Fort Wayne as well. And having this laurel, like, you know, that's like part of our press release, and like it's a little more relevant to an Indiana audience now. You know, maybe people have heard of Heartland but don't live close enough to Indianapolis or didn't make it out, you know. Now that's a piece of PR that I have.
Yeah. 30 years, it really has grown into something special. Well, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
For taking the time to join us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Andrew Paul Davis is creative director and founder of One County Film Company and director of the film Pompano Boy, featured at this year's Heartland International Film Festival. And now we are going to bring in someone from behind the scenes. Greg Sorvig is artistic director at Heartland Film. Thank you so much for joining us today, Greg.
Hey, thank you. And I tell you what, my voice is already hoarse, so forgive me, but I've been back at the movies and it's been fantastic. So talking to filmmakers, talking to attendees, it's good to be out and showing movies again.
Yeah. We know last year the festival was modified somewhat. Talk about what's different at the festival this year.
Yeah, last year obviously was full pandemic. You know, no one was ready to go back to the movies, nor were a lot of movies coming out. So we worked with the TIPS Drive-In. We did 17 drive-in screenings and did everything virtually, which was, again, we were excited to still have a festival, filmmakers are really positive in adapting to that. And now we still have virtual this year. We have over 80 movies from around the world that people can still watch from the convenience of their home. But we're also back in theaters. And it's not just returning to theaters, but we have fantastic new venues that have actually opened during the pandemic too. So it's an all new experience and really celebrating the community here in Indiana. So we're at Living Room Theaters in the Bottle Works District, which is a beautiful place. So much to do, and the visiting filmmakers have really loved that location. Additionally, not too far away in the Windsor Park area is the Can Can Cinema and Brasserie. We're there as well. It's a great venue, great food, great people that run that establishment too, and we're so excited to be there too. So two new venues. We had an outdoor screening at the Indianapolis Arts Center as well on Saturday night. And we're also at Newfields. And we're also at the historic Artcraft Theater again, which is down in Franklin. So beautiful, almost 100-year-old theater with a beautiful Blade marquee. It's a great experience. And we're even showing some throwback films since it's our 30th anniversary. We played a retrospective screening of West Side Story at our first festival back in 92. And we're playing it again for our 30th anniversary on 35mm film. So a lot going on, and we're really excited to be back.
Do you think that virtual component is here to stay for some film festivals?
You know what? I really do, especially since a lot of attendees of art house cinema and festivals do skew on the older side, or they have been over the years, but we keep growing audiences too through the expansion of our short festival, Indie Shorts as well. And a lot of these big titles, we have a lot of first-time attendees, but virtual is a great option, especially during the pandemic. If some people still aren't quite ready to go to theaters, you know, we have still wearing masks within the theaters too, but we have seen probably even a bigger response to virtual than even we anticipated since going back to theaters. So yeah, it's almost like running two events simultaneously. But again, you know, just how people consume media and movies, it's a great option. And I think festivals were kind of scared to go that route just based on cost and availability. But now it's an option. So we're definitely glad to have it.
So what's the makeup of films like this year? Can you give us a sense for the breakdown, big budget movies? I know you have some local projects, documentaries.
Yeah, it's really great how we've expanded over the years. It was just a few dozen films. And then now we've expanded. We have 143 films from around the world. And we've really become an Oscar stop in the last 5 years especially. So we have 14 major event films. So we just had the Midwest premiere of Spencer starring Kristen Stewart from Neon, which is a huge Oscar contender. We have the new Wes Anderson film, first time we've had a Wes Anderson film at Heartland with the French Dispatch on Thursday. We have the Midwest premiere of King Richard from Warner Brothers starring Will Smith. So a lot of amazing, huge titles, big stars that we have here too. So we have that reputation with the studios that you can see some of these Oscar contenders first here. But those are kind of event films, special presentations from the bigger distributors. But still at our core, we highlight these independent films that don't yet have distribution as official selections. So they're the ones that are really up for the big grand prizes as well. We've given $3.5 million to independent filmmakers since 1992, which is the most a film festival in North America has given. So we really support that storytelling and the independent filmmakers as well. So yeah, we have, like we talked with filmmakers here today that are films that are Indiana centric, either by Hoosiers or made here in Indiana. So we have an Indiana Spotlight competition. We want to continue doing that, offering cash prizes and highlighting our local filmmakers. We have films, like I said, from all over the world, documentaries, dramatic films as well, and some encore screenings of our short films too, and some retrospectives this year. Like I said, West Side Story. We have a partnership with Jimmy Stewart's family, and we have an award that we give in his honor, and we're showing Rope in addition to Harvey as well. So, yeah, it's a great mix of films from, hey, I can brag about seeing this movie first at Heartland. That's going to you're going to hear again back in February or March for the Oscars in the award season, to these, you know, even 20 U.S. and world premieres of films that are just debuting here, starting their festival journey. But again, in spite of everything, we have still have 100 filmmakers visiting. So really would love people to come out and check out films. And in my intro so far, we kicked off on Thursday. I've been asking people if they could raise their hand if it's their first movie since the pandemic started. And about half of each audience raises their hand. So it's very special to us that people are coming back and celebrating through Heartland. So we're very fortunate.
So was it hard to sort of figure out how to get back into it, handle in-person screenings while we're still working our way through this, get back to the red carpet? Is there a good blueprint now?
Yeah, you know what? I think that's the neat thing. I think over the years, you can maybe go on autopilot. Oh, we've done that. Let's keep doing that. But we have had to look and redefine with surveys, with staffing, with everything, with budgets. How can we continue to maintain a great fest after 3 decades? But be realistic as well. So in the past, we had maybe 400 screening slots over 11 days. So that's limited this year to about 160. So we just wanted to make sure that we could honor every film. Sometimes films would play multiple times. This year, every film is playing at least once in person. A couple other films are playing encore screening or two. But we did make that decision as well to go ahead and do that. So we wanted to come back to theaters, but not go too wild. We still wanted to be a little bit conservative. And hopefully that people would come. If you build it, they would come. And we're seeing that, so we're really excited.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, some of the great new venues that are here in Indiana, like Bottleworks and Can-Can. And there's still a lot of uncertainty around the future of movie theaters, though. What do you see as the future, and is there a growing market for these sort of art house cinemas?
Yeah, you know what? I think, you know, when films were coming back, and even a lot of the studios worked with these art house cinemas virtually to do ticket splits, I think the art house cinema is where true cinema is going to live. You know, there's always going to be the big tentpole movies. There's always going to be the next Star Wars, Marvel, Fast and the Furious now. But these art house cinemas, they offer the true experience, because that's what we've seen. You know, I'm watching something, you know, air quote, watching something at home, and maybe I'm fiddling with my phone or distracted by something else or want to press pause. But I mean, it's, you're back. You're focused on this film with a community, with like-minded people that you probably might not even never meet again or have met because you are at the movies. So I think the experiential community aspect of it, I know there's the Indianapolis Film Project, part of the Can-Can as well. There's the great, you know, the Brasserie, the restaurant there. There's a fantastic, you know, again, it's a big social area too around Bottleworks, with the garage, with the hotel, with Pins Mechanical. So again, that's what festivals are all about. It's not just the movies. It's the movies plus. It's an experience, a curated experience with other people that makes it exciting that you're part of something. And I don't think that's ever going to go away.
Oh, real quick, what movie are you most excited to see this year?
Oh, wow. I'll tell you what. I'll tell you what. I'm just really excited to show King Richard with Will Smith. It's a fantastic film. It has not been booked at many festivals. We worked with Warner Brothers on a sneak peek, and it's our anniversary gala. So again, a film that celebrates the past, a perfect film that embodies the mission of Heartland and kind of looking towards the future too. So that's Saturday at Newfields, this special advanced anniversary gala of King Richard.
Well, congratulations, and thank you, Greg.
Hey, thank you so much.
Greg Sorvig is artistic director of the Heartland Film, and thanks to all of our guests for taking time today. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan. Thanks for listening. This is All In.